people don't know, he's giving two talks, one at the Lynn, around 5, and then an extension, we'll take a 10-minute break, and we can do right after that for another hour.
No, so it's more like one talk with an escape, a time for escape in the middle, okay? So my talk will follow a handout. There are copies over there. I hope everybody has copies. Here it is on the screen. And my title is here, and I should say that I've invited myself to come here. So thanks for accepting my invitation and letting me speak. Also, I should say that several places within the handout, there appears the acronym Omega Epsilon Beta, and it stands for this URL where you can find all the further information, okay? And it's work in progress, and also a disclaimer. So everything that I'll be telling you about is quite new, and everything is correct, but some pieces are definitely not in their final form, so things will move, will change in the future. Maybe I'll start with a tour. Okay, so here's what I'm going to tell you in the next 2 hours. That's a brief tour, okay? So I have a certain new polynomial time, not polynomial, to tell you about and to show you that I'm serious. I've computed it for all knots with up to 12 crossings and for certain knots with up to 48 crossings. And here is a log-log time of the computation, log-log plot of the computation time. So if you plot the log of the number of crossings against the log of the computation time, and if it's polynomial, the plot should be linear. And it's more or less linear, okay? So that's just evidence that I'm not telling you complete lies. The other point is that the invariant not only is computable, but also has a meaning when it comes to the genus of the knot, and when it comes to whether knots are ribbon or not ribbon, and I will describe these things later, and that's, I'm still doing just the preview tour, right? So finally, the next thing is that I think one of the reasons I'm very, very happy about it is because it involves kind of a strange kind of algebra that probably most of you are not aware of. So you can approximate semi-simple algebras by solvable algebras. And I think it's nowhere in the books. So it's kind of, this in itself is kind of a nice new thing. And the invariant I'm going to tell you about works via solvable approximation of SL2. So I will tell you what that is later on. And unfortunately, there are also some bad news. So everything will depend on knowing some master polynomial, which we call the logos, which is a principle of logos in Greek is principle of order and knowledge. So if you know this polynomial, you know everything else, but it's ugly. Okay? On the other hand, everything can be implemented. This is the complete program that implements the hardest bits of what I will be telling you about today. So it's not, if it fits on one screen, it's not so bad, okay? And let me start. No, it's not yet start. I'm still just mumbling. So first of all, the history. So the history is a bit strange. My personal history is that I've been working on something else until a year and a half ago, knowing that this is around the corner. And a year and a half ago, I started working on this. And only about a month ago, And then things finally matured a few months ago. And then only about a month ago, I was visiting the University of North Carolina, and I realized that Rozanski was describing essentially the same thing, not essentially, the same thing 15 years ago or so, 13, 12, I don't know. And in fact, his student, Andrea Overbay, computed quite a lot of it. However, they completely failed to market what they have done, and partially they completely failed to understand that what they have done is spectacular. So in a way, I'm only telling you about their spectacular work, though my approach along with Roland van der Veen is different, and you'll see it later. There is a further ridiculous aspect to this story, And this is the reason, part of the reason why Rosansky only published it in one remote place, and Overbay has it only on the University of North Carolina library system and nowhere else. So part of the reason is my fault, because about 12 years ago I came to North Carolina, and Rosansky was telling me parts of this story, and I was telling him about Romanov homology, which was fresh and new, and I managed to convince him to switch directions, and therefore this never got completed. And he did wonderful things about knot homologies, but I think this is more valuable. Anyway, so very briefly and without details, here is what the Rosansky thing is about. So it actually starts with a conjecture of Melvin and Morton, which was elucidated by Rosansky and then proven by myself and Garofalidis. And without going into details, there is something called, because the details are totally unnecessary for what I'm going to tell you about now. It's just background, okay? So there is something called the Collor-Jones polynomial, and it depends on two parameters, the Q of quantum group theory, okay, and D, the dimension of a certain representation of SL2. And if you reparameterize it, write it at Q equals E to the H, and then rewrite it as, and then renormalize a little bit, and then rewrite it as a power series in D and H, since it's a power series in two variables, you get an array of coefficients. And then the Melvin-Morton conjecture said that if you look in this array of coefficients, below the diagonal, you see, below the diagonals, you see zero, and on the diagonal, you see the most important knot polynomial, or in fact, its inverse, the power series, which is its inverse, namely the Alexander polynomial. And the new stuff that that Rosansky studied later and that I'm going to describe to you now is essentially the diagonal above the Alexander diagonal, and also further diagonals above that, but essentially such diagonals turn into power series and then into polynomials. More precisely, Rosansky's theorem is that you can write the Jones polynomial at color D at parameter Q when sufficiently renormalized as 1 over the Alexander polynomial times 1, 1 is this diagonal, plus a certain power series, and the coefficients of this power series are new knot polynomials, and the new information that I'm going to tell you is that these knot polynomials are extremely easy to compute in a computational complexity sense, and that they contain topological information. So why do I think that this is spectacular? So the foremost reason is obviously, okay? I mean, if you have a knot polynomial which you can actually compute, it's clearly better than what than a lot of what is happening in knot theory, which is you prove that something incomputable at a certain extreme limit is equal to something else which cannot be computed anyway, or you categorify something which you couldn't compute to start with. So it's obviously interesting, but there are also other reasons. And here are the other reasons. So first of all, there is something called the genus of the knot. The genus of a knot is, well, a topological quantity that people want to compute. And what it is it's the minimal genus of a ciphered surface whose boundary is the knot. Now, this turns out to have a very simple-minded description in terms of tangles. So what is a tangle? First of all. So a tangle is a knot or a part of a knot drawn inside a disk or possibly inside a half space. So maybe a thing like, This is a tangle. Well, this one I just make it a little bit more interesting. Okay, so this is a tangle, or I could have drawn it in an upper half space. Okay. So if you have a tangle with two G components, so here are the components and how they connect to the line at the bottom of the half space. Okay, so 2G components, G is equal to 2 right here, so 4 components. I'm not telling you how they're knotted. So, I mean, really, these components can be knotted with each other in a complicated way. Anyway, if you have such a tangle, there is a way to get a knot out of it. And the way is you double each strand, so each strand becomes a pair of strands, like here, except these were knotted with each other, so these bands could also be knotted with each other. And then you connect the bottom pieces in a certain way, so you connect just as shown here, and then what you got is a long knot. Okay? Clearly the long knot that you got has a genus at most 2, because here is a ciphered surface whose genus is 2 and whose boundary is this knot. And furthermore, it's very easy to show that every knot of genus at most 2 comes from this procedure. So this is just general background. And then, by the way, in this talk, the first hour will be general background, and then the second hour will be the actual construction. So basically, if you had a knot invariant, which is well behaved under all of these operations, so has a good doubling formula, and has good formulas to stitch one component to the next, then a priori, it is likely to say something about genus, or it may say something about genus. And what I'm going to tell you is that the invariant that I'm about to describe has such formulas. Okay, and therefore it may say something about the genus of a knot, and experimentally it actually does say something about the genus of the knot. Okay? Likewise, there is something called ribbon knots. So let me remind you what these are. Tell me, by the way, if I'm sort of if this is embarrassing and I should be moving to more interesting things. But so okay, a ribbon knot is a red knot which can be presented as the boundary of a blue membrane, which is a disk topologically, and which is allowed to have some singularities. And the singularities are ribbon-type singularities. So basically, parts of the disks that look like ribbons can intersect themselves the way ribbons intersect, like that. Okay? So then you have a line of singularities where the membrane intersects itself, and the line starts and ends on the knot. Okay? From the perspective of the vertical component, from the perspective of the other component, this green line of singularities starts and ends at an interior point of the membrane. However, there are other types of singularities that are not allowed. So there is something called a clasp singularity, and one is shown here. And this one is not allowed in a ribbon knot. So what's a clasp singularity? It's a green line of intersections between the blue membrane and itself, and which starts at from the perspective of one side, it looks like a line that starts on the boundary and ends at an interior point, and from the perspective of the other side, it starts at an interior point and ends at the boundary. So these singularities are not allowed. Here is a ribbon knot. So you can look at it, it's a ribbon, it's a knot. The blue membrane here clearly is a disk. It has two self-intersections, and both of them are clearly ribbon singularities, so this is a ribbon knot. Many knots are not ribbon, and the question is to tell which are ribbon and which are not. Okay? Now, in particular, there is a famous conjecture that ribbon is equal to slice. So what's a slice knot? Again, in a few words, so a slice knot is a knot which can be drawn on in S3. So the ball shown, the sphere shown here is S3. S3 is the boundary of a ball, a four-dimensional ball. And then you can ask if you can find a disk, a smooth disk, in the four-dimensional ball whose boundary is on the boundary of that ball, meaning on S3, and is that knot? Okay? So it's very easy to show that a ribbon knot is slice. Right? Because if you have a ribbon membrane like this, you can just push its inside, you can push the inside of the ribbon down to negative fourth dimension, so, or into the ball, and then it's easy to arrange it in such a way that all the intersections disappear. Okay? But the other direction is an open problem, and in fact, there is a famous conjecture, I'm phrasing it in the way people now believe it, but nobody can prove it, that some slice knots are actually not ribbon. Now, how would you tell if in fact there are suggested counterexamples, and I'll show you one in a minute. So really what we're missing is a tool to show that some knots are not ribbon. So one such tool is the Fox-Milner theorem. The Fox-Milner theorem says that the Alexander polynomial of a ribbon knot, so call it A of t, it's a Laurent polynomial, and the claim is that it's always of the form f of t times f of 1 over t, where f is some other Laurent polynomial. Okay? So now, not all polynomials are of this form. For example, you know, a polynomial which is of this form would have its roots being pairs t and 1 over t. And clearly not all polynomials have roots like that. So if you find a knot and you compute its Alexander polynomial and it's not of that form, then you know it's not a ribbon knot. Unfortunately, the Fox-Milner theorem also holds for slice knots. So this criteria is not going to separate ribbon knots from slice knots. But my hope is to find other knot invariants with other similar criteria that would separate ribbon from slice. And I want to tell you why the thing I'm going to tell you about has a chance. Okay? So why does it have a chance? I suppose before telling you why it has a chance, we have to understand a little bit more about tangles. Okay? So what's a tangle for me today? I already told you a preview. I'll say a little bit more. So a tangle is, again, a piece of a knot drawn inside a piece of the plane. So it has several components. Component number one, component number two, I think, starts here and goes like that. Or, of course, this is just an example, right? And I insist that my components will be intervals, so no closed components. No components that look like a circle. So I'm not allowing you to put a component that would look like a closed circle. So tangles actually contain ordinary knots, because every ordinary knot can be written as a long knot, right, as a knotting of an interval which goes where the ends go to infinity. However, this my type of tangles do not contain links, because there is no canonical way of identifying several connected, several closed components inside a tangle, with tangles. So anyway, these are the tangles that I consider. And I should have said, all components are directed and all components are labeled by some finite set, not necessarily the integers, though here I chose 1, 2, 4. Okay, are you with me? Is this okay so far? Okay, there are two operations that I want to tell you about when it comes to tangles. Okay, one is the disjoint union operation. So if you have two tangles, T1 and T2, and supposing the set of labels of the strands that appears in, the sets are disjoint, then I can just put the two components side by side, and I get a bigger tangle with the union of the sets of labels. Okay? And you can argue with me that this is not entirely well defined, because, for example, this end, am I going to pull it down to the bottom or up to the top? And the answer is, that's the parenthesis V here, virtual tangles. And I'm not going to tell you what virtual tangles are, but in virtual tangles, it doesn't matter. And in everything that I will do that will follow, it will clearly not matter. Okay? So just ignore this ambiguity. Okay? And then there is a second operation. This was a binary operation. There is a second operation, which is unary. But even though it's unary, it looks a bit like multiplication, so I call it M, though probably a better name is stitching. So what is stitching? So you have your base tangle, your original tangle, and it has two strands in it, one labeled A and the other labeled B. The stitching MABC operation takes the head of A, connects it in the most direct route possible to the tail of B, and therefore creates a new tangle with one fewer strands, and calls the resulting strand, which is the merge of the two original strands, it calls it C. So that's the stitching operation. Okay? So in what way is it like multiplication? It's like multiplication in that it is a little bit associative. So let me explain in what way it is a little bit associative. So suppose you have a tangle with three components in it, one called A, the other called B, and the last one called C. Okay? And of course they can be knotted inside. I'm just showing the skeleton, the schematics. Then if you stitch A and B together and then stitch the result to C, you clearly get the same thing as if when you stitch B and C together and then stitch A and B. So, and that's kind of like associativity, so I call it the meta-associativity axiom. And more specifically, it says that if you stitch A and B, call the result temporary name X, and then follow it by, so double slash mean composition where you compose from left to right, the way God created composition. Okay? Not the funny circle way. Okay? So you stitch A and B, call the result X, then you stitch X to C, call the result Y. This is the same as stitching B and C, calling the result X, and then stitching A to X, calling the result Y, exactly what I wrote here. Now, it's not associativity, even though it looks very much like associativity, it's meta-associativity, because it's about unary operation, it's not even about multiplication. Okay? Yes?
And the parenthesis V also means it's okay to do this when A and B aren't near each other?
Right. So in fact, as stated, these operations are well defined only if the strands A, if the head of A is neighboring to the tail of B. But in V tangles, which I'm not defining, it makes sense regardless of that. And in everything that I will do, this will be irrelevant, whether the strands are nearby or not. Okay? Good. How is this related to ribbon knots? Okay? So, here is a little theorem. So first of all, suppose you have a tangle with, two N strands in it, and they're shown dotted here. The dotted parts can be knotted, tangled with each other, but my only insistence is that this one will be connected to here, this will be connected to here, so the skeleton is as shown. Then here are two operations that you can do to this tangle. One is the tau closure. So the tau closure would be to stitch this tip to this tip and this tip to this tip, so you get a result like this. And this is again a tangle, but with instead of two N components, now it has N components. And then the second operation is the kappa closure. So tau for the result is a tangle, and kappa for the result is a knot. The kappa closure is you stitch ends at the bottom, as stated, and at the top with a shift of one. So you stitch the second to the third, and then the third to the fifth, the fourth, and then you leave the first and the last, the number one and the number two end, unstitched. This is a tangle with one component. A tangle with one component is just a knot. Okay? So now I've defined tau and kappa. And theorem, a ribbon knot, a ribbon K inside tangles with one component is exactly the kappa closures of the elements of T2n, of tangles with 2n components, whose tau closure is unknotted, is the trivial picture like this. So you can entertain yourself by trying to prove this theorem. One direction is easy, the other direction is hard. Okay? And you can also entertain yourself by verifying that the example that I've shown here is an example. So if you take the kappa closure, the tau closure, the result, well, you stitch this to this and you stitch this to this, and then sort of everything kind of can be trivialized. Basically, this can be swallowed in, and this can be swallowed in, and then it's hard to see, but you can continue simplifying. On the other hand, if you do the kappa closure, so you stitch this to this, and this to this, and this to this, you get a non-trivial knot, and in fact, it's the knot that I was showing before, the ribbon knot that I was showing before. Anyway, so now, suppose you had an invariant Z, which is well-behaved under stitching. So it's an invariant Z which maps tangles on 2n strands to some algebra sub 2n. So when I say algebra sub 2n, I mean some space that people in algebra like to study. 2n by 2n matrices. I don't know, 2n dimensional vector spaces. Rings of a certain kind with 2n indeterminates. Something studied in algebra. So suppose you had an invariant taking T2n to A2n, Tn to An, and T1 into A1. And furthermore, suppose you had algebraic tau operation and algebraic kappa operations. So suppose you had operations that intertwined stitching with your invariant. So you had stitching on the algebraic side as well. Okay? Then you'd get a diagram like the diagram shown here. So Z would map this to this, and this to this, and this to this, and everything would be commutative. And then you can check that in that case, oh, and furthermore, let's declare that the image of U under Z is called 1. Just let's call it 1. The image of the unknot is 1. And then it's very easy to check that a ribbon knot would have its invariant inside the subset R of A1, where the subset R is you start with 1, take its tau inverse, and then project with kappa. Okay? So that's, in principle, an algebraic condition. R was algebraically defined. So it's an algebraic condition on the value of the invariant. If you find an invariant for which all of this work and for which R is actually different from A1, in principle you can detect non-ribbon knots. What would it take for this to work? Okay, first of all, you need invariants that can be computed really, really quickly, so faster is better. Because the smallest counterexample, the smallest potential counterexample I'm aware of for ribbon equals slice, so the smallest knot which we know is slice, but we think is not ribbon, is due to Gompf, Sharman, and Thompson, and is shown here, and it has 48 crossings. So you must be able to compute quickly. Okay? And then there is actually a subtler point, which is leaner is meaner. So basically, you expect this algebraic space, An, to have dimension that grows as a function of N. So the more component you have the tangle, the more space you need in order to describe it algebraically. It's easy to show that if An grows very rapidly, so the more rapidly An grows, the less likely it is that kappa of tau inverse of 1 will be an actual subspace of A1, an actual subset of A1. Generically, if the dimensions grow very rapidly, R should be should be everything. Okay? So the slower An grows, the better. And that's the meaning of meaner is meaner. But the other thing is that things that grow more slowly are actually more computable. If you have spaces whose dimension grow slowly, then you're more likely to be able to compute in these spaces. So you'll have to keep this in mind as I show you various spaces, and keep in mind that their dimensions grow slowly, and that's somehow part of the point. Okay? By the way, the Alexander polynomial of this knot, or rather only the positive powers, is given by this formula. And just to show you that I'm serious, the invariant that I'm going to describe later, rho 1, and again, I'm showing only the positive powers, is given by this messy formula. So things really are computable. I really mean it when I say compute. Are you still with me? Okay. So maybe a bit of an aside to make Paul Kirk and Chuck Livingston happy is the gold standard for such invariants of tangles. So the gold standard is what I call gamma calculus, and gamma calculus is a certain tangle calculus that computes the Alexander polynomial and has all the properties that I listed, that I want. Okay? So let me brief. So basically, I aim to imitate this. So this is, if you want, an example. Okay? So what's a gamma calculus? So if you have an S component tangle T, so S is a finite set, so it's the set of labels of components, then it has values, that invariant, I first have to tell you what the target space, so it has values in a certain ring R sub S times set theoretic times, not tensor product, not direct sum, not nothing. Set theoretic times is the set of S by S matrices with entries in that ring, where the ring is the ring of rational functions with integer coefficients in variables, one variable for each component of the tangle. Okay? So actually, I already lied a little bit, because you see, this ring grows extremely quickly as a function of the number of components. The size of this ring grows quickly as the size of the number of components. So there is so after you do everything that I tell you, you identify all of these variables to be one single variable. You just declare that all of the variables are the same, and then it matches all the conditions that I stated before. Okay, maybe I should have done it to start with. Maybe I should have never told you that there is a multivariable version, but I got tempted. You know, the story is stronger than the most naive, so I got tempted and I'm showing you the stronger form, even though the stronger form actually doesn't meet my conditions, my criteria. Okay, one more thing. So if you have an element in the target space, it has a scalar part and a matrix part. And the matrix has rows and columns labeled by S. So the way I write it, such a matrix, is I write it as an array like this, where here is the matrix part, here are row labels, here are column labels, they're labeled by the same set, and then I have one space left at the top left, that's where I stick the scalar part. This is just my notation, okay? So now I need to tell you, oh, I forgot to tell you one important thing. With these two operations, maybe I'll go back to that slide. So with these two operations that I listed here, disjoint union and stitching, the set of tangles is finitely generated. In fact, it's finitely presented, but let's not talk about it. Okay? So why is it finitely generated? Because, well, the two generators are the overcrossing and the undercrossing. If you wanted to write an arbitrary tangle as a, well, I know that the stuff I'm doing is extremely valuable, but I still should be able to erase it. So I found the eraser. So if I wanted to create an arbitrary tangle using my generators, so here are my two generators. Well, I just take many copies of these two generators and take their disjoint union. So I have one tangle which looks like the disjoint union of a bunch of crossings. And then I tell you, stitch this to this, 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 and clearly this way I can get whatever I want. So finite generation is a non-issue. But the moment you know that you're seeking an invariant which is well behaved under these two operations, then all I need to tell you is how these two operations act on the target space, and what are the values on the generators? And that would be a complete description of the invariant. So for the gold standard, for the gamma calculus, the value of the overcrossing, so the overcrossing will be is a tiny tangle with two strands, one labeled A, the other labeled B, and the value will be a 2x2 matrix with one row column labeled A, one column labeled B, one row labeled A, one row labeled B, and that matrix will be the matrix written here with a plus sign. And it's a matrix of rational functions in these variables, T sub A and T sub B. Only T sub A appears. And the scalar part will be 1. And for the negative crossing, it's the same but with minus 1. Okay? Then I have to tell you how the invariant behaves under disjoint union. So if you have T1 and T2, and their invariants are basically, I failed to write this, but basically they are this with omega 1 and omega 1 and omega 1 A1 or omega 2 A2. Okay? Then their disjoint union will be the scalar part gets multiplied and the matrix part. You just take the block diagonal direct sum of the block, what is it called? The block sum of the two matrices. Okay? And finally, I have to tell you how stitching works. So, stitching is complicated. So, suppose you have, you've computed the invariant of a tangle, it came out a matrix and a scalar, and But I have two components that are highlighted, components A and B, the two components that I want to stitch. So the matrix will have a column for A, a column for B, and then a bunch of columns for the rest, and then a row for A, a row for B, and then a bunch of rows for the rest. So it will be like a 3x3 matrix, alpha, beta, gamma, theta, where alpha is a scalar, because this is a single column and this is a single row. Beta is a scalar, gamma is a scalar, delta is a scalar. Theta is a whole row of entries, like all the rest, and you can tell it's a row because it has a bar, a horizontal bar in the middle. Likewise epsilon, likewise phi with a vertical bar, and likewise psi with a vertical bar. And this is an n-2 by n-2 matrix, psi. Okay? And then, after you compute the invariant, you stitch and then compute the invariant, and the result will be, so first of all, you identify the variables TA and TB and call the result TC. The scalar part, instead of omega, it will be omega times 1 minus beta, where beta is the quantity written here. And the matrix part is given by this ugly formula. And if you look at this ugly formula, it completely makes sense. So for example, psi times theta, this is a column times a row, you get a matrix, and then you add it to psi, which is again a matrix, so it at least makes sense. Okay? By the way, Roland likes to say, I'll mention Roland later, but Roland likes to say that there is some verbal description to it, which is a bit better than just the Greek letters. Okay? Now, this might look horrible. Hopefully it looks horrible. Okay? But it's a one-box description of an extension of the Alexander polynomial for tangles. And, right, when I say one box, I mean, you know, this is this blue box surrounding it. Whereas papers that did it before did it in 48 pages or so, right? And their authors are in the room. And furthermore, sorry, I failed to tell you, for long knots, the omega part, the scalar part, is the Alexander polynomial. And furthermore, this turns out to be the fastest way we know to compute the Alexander polynomial. I mean, it might look horrible, but it's actually extremely efficient. And in fact, Nathan Dunfield implemented it in Python and was able to compute it for knots with up to 1,000 crossings. And finally, I haven't written the formulas, but there are formulas for strand doubling and strand reversal, so you can use it to discuss genus. And I'm not telling you the results of the discussion because they are the standard results. You get what you would expect. Okay. One last thing before I start with today's invariant. Sorry, it's a long, long, long introduction. I hope you forgive me. And if you don't forgive me, I'll take a 10-minute break at 5 and then you can just leave. So, everything that I'm going to tell you later is inspired by a certain theorem which I'm not going to even properly state. But it's a certain... So, there is something called the Kontsievich integral. And the Kontsievich integral is a certain universal, not invariant, universal in a certain clear sense. And it's completely impossible to compute, except for various small cases. But generally speaking, it's impossible to compute. However, it takes values inside a huge target space. But this huge target space has many quotient spaces, some of which are potentially computable. Now, that I knew for like 15 years or more, 20, and I've been struggling to get something out of it and failed. However, there is an extension of the Kontsievich integral. So there is something called virtual knots, and I've hinted about them already before. And then there is a universal invariant of virtual knots, and it takes values in a space very similar to the space where the Kontsievich integral takes values, except instead of undirected chords that appear in the Kontsievich integral, all of the chords here have arrows on them. And the existence of this invariant is actually, well, it's implicit in the work of Ettinghoff and Kashdan and Enricos and Chevera on quantization of Levi algebras and quantization of Young-Baxter operators. And it's more explicit in the work of Haviv, which unfortunately nobody read. But again, this invariant has the same unwanted property that the target space is absolutely huge. On the other hand, it has even better quotients than the Kontsievich integral. And really everything that I will tell you about is about quotients of this, about reductions of this invariant, even though it will not look like that. But that's just one word about the inspiration for people who already know something. Okay, if not, please forgive me for ignore what I just said. Can I move on? Is this okay? Okay. So in a way, now starts the construction part. Okay? So far it was introduction. Even the construction has an introduction. So so given any unital algebra, so a unital algebra is just a unit, an algebra that has a unit in it, okay? And it's actually even better if the algebra is a Hopf algebra, because then you can talk about strand doubling, but I'm not going to talk about this. So let's just restrict our attentions to just pure algebras, simple-minded algebras. And in fact, typically, and this will be the case in what follows, the algebra will be the universal enveloping algebra of some Lie algebra. And in fact, usually completed, so you have to allow infinite sums and not just finite sums. And things would have to be graded so that you can complete, and I'll mention the grading later. Okay? But if you don't, but don't worry about it. Just pretend that e to the x makes sense, even though it's not a polynomial but a power series. Okay? So given such an algebra, and then an appropriate element R of the algebra tensor itself, and I will always denote it, not always, but I will denote it in orange often, and in fact also elements which appear in gray so that you don't, so that you see them but immediately forget that you saw them, and let's call them the quaps. So quaps stand for caps and caps. Okay? So ignore them, they're not important. So given such R and quaps, you get an invariant of S component tangles with values in the algebra tensor itself S times. How? Sorry, but I should say that I said the word appropriate here. So there has to be some, these R's and the quap, R and the quaps should satisfy some equations, which I'm not showing at the moment. Okay? So how do you do that? So basically, you take your tangle. Here is an example tangle called T0. I think it's in fact the same one that was shown here, that I drew here before I added the spurious component. So basically, it's one strand just goes straight, and the other one goes like that. And basically, at every cross, so okay, you think of every strand as representing one tensor factor in this tensor product. So really every strand corresponds to the algebra. So you can deposit elements of the algebra along a strand and then multiply along the strand. Right? And then, yes?
What's the word strand mean in your picture? Like how strand many strands are in that picture?
Two. So strand is one thing that starts at the end, at the boundary of the tangle, goes through the tangle, and comes out at somewhere else. That's a strand. Okay? So basically, if you deposit elements of the algebra along a strand, you can multiply them, and you get one element of the algebra for that strand. So what you do is you take, for this case, because here we have three crossings. So this tangle has three crossings. So for each crossing, you take a copy of R. So you get something in A tensor A. So something in A tensor A is really sort of two sets of elements in A. So you deposit some of them on the upper strand. So basically the first A, you deposit on the upper strand near the crossing, and the second copy of A, you deposit on the lower strand near the crossing. So here I labeled sort of zones, so the first copy of R gets deposited on zone 5 and zone 1, the second copy of R gets deposited on zone 2 and zone 4, and basically and so on, and then you multiply along the strands. This is, by the way, people here such as Turayev did a lot of work on that. Not such as, Turayev, on things like that. And again, the thing in gray is that you have to deposit stuff on the caps and on the caps and cups, namely on the quaps, but I'm not telling you, but ignore this. So first approximation, it's better not to think about it. And then, well, by the way, an alternative way to view it is to say that, well, you kind of straightened the components. So the first component becomes just a vertical bar with zones 1 and 2 along it. And the second component becomes a strand called Y, and it's again a vertical bar, and along it you see zones 3 and then 4 and then 5 and then 6. And the copies of R look odd, but you're depositing half of this R at the bottom and half of the other half at the top, and then you multiply. And then if these R's satisfy an equation which is not hard to write, and it's called the Young-Baxter equation, then this is invariant under the, what is it called, the Rademacher 3 move, and you get a not invariant. And you also need some equations for the quaps. Okay, but again, that's less important, okay? Okay, so this invariant looks like a big sum of things of the form, so you know, let's pretend that our algebra A was generated by four generators, C which is red, U which is green, W which is blue, and B which is just a bar, okay? Then the first R will deposit blue, red, blue, the second R will deposit blue, red, red, green, so you get sort of a big sum of things like that. And the only problem is that we've turned the topology problem to an algebra problem. How do I tell if two sums like this are the same? Right? Specifically, I told you that these are the generators. I didn't tell you that they're free. Maybe you can commute them across each other. So how do I tell if two such sums are the same? Okay? So in other words, so the good news, as I said here, is that in order to construct an invariant, all you need to know is what is R and what are the quaps, and stitching becomes just multiplication. Stitching of two strands just become, well, you multiply what's written on one with what's written on the other. So that's the good news. The problem is, how do you extract information out of it? Okay? Okay, the textbook solution for extracting information is to use representation theory. Namely, you find some representation of your algebra A into some finite dimensional matrices, and then every blue thing becomes a matrix, and this all becomes matrix multiplication and multiplications, and when you multiply matrices, it's very easy to tell if the end result, whether the end results are the same or not. So that's the standard solution, and it gives the so-called Reshetichin-Turayev invariants. However, and it works. However, it works really, really slowly. Because if you have a tangle with W strands, you will be looking at a representation tensor itself W times, the dimension of this is exponential in W, and if you work with matrices whose dimensions are exponentials, and you want to do anything with it, it will take at least exponential time. Okay? So it works, but slowly. Now, and you will need wide tangles. You will need tangles with many strands along the way, because I told you how you generate the world of tangles. Right, you start with very wide tangles, right? Tangles which are disjoint union of many crossings. So they have many, many strands, and then you stitch and they become narrow, and they have less and less strands, fewer and fewer strands. But at least at the start, you're working with tangles that are very, very wide, very many strands in them. So this works, but slowly. And today's solution, is it time for break? I think I have 5 more minutes. Is this okay? Okay, so today's solution is, well, you actually do the more naive thing. So my algebras will always be universal enveloping algebras of some Lie algebras. You bring, you use the PBW theorem, to sort all of these things so that all the blues are at the bottom, and then all the C's, and then all the U's, and then all the greens, all reds, and all, then all the greens, and all the blues. Now, when you sort, there is cost. Like, when you commute things across each other, you have to pay with some commutator. So, but anyway, you bring it to canonical form. Also, you bring to canonical form all the payments that you have to pay. And that's your result, right? The problem is, for mostly algebras, this is completely impossible. So if you're talking about semi-simple algebras, then the PBW theorem is a nice theoretical theorem, but you cannot use it in practice. You try, it fails. You get formulas that you cannot work with. Okay? So today's solution, which is joined with Roland van der Veen, whom I should introduce even earlier, but anyway, here he is. Roland meets everybody. So is to, for some specifically algebras, we work with some specific type of formulas for elements in U of G tensor to the S. And these formulas are what we will call ordered perturbed Gaussian formulas. And then this space is huge, but this space is tiny, relatively speaking, and we will end up showing that we don't need to come out of this space, that all operations stay within this space. So our invariant will end up being the formula for the invariant here. Okay? Yeah, maybe this is a good time to take a break. Is this okay if we do? Okay. So, okay. 5, 10 minutes? What are the rules here?
Let's call it 10.
Okay, so 10 minutes break.
Let's give you a thank you for those who were classic.
Okay.